Go ahead and talk on it. Put the date on it and where you're at and what you're going to do. Identify your tape.
Okay. This is the... we're at the Tanana Yukon Historical Society at Fairbanks, Alaska, January the 24th, 1963.
Now, you know, John,
this is not on the air, are you? Go ahead, Neil. Yeah.
It's all right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bob. Jump that.
Well, ladies and gentlemen of the Historical Society, I've been asked to introduce a man who some people may think is a chichico or whatever you call them. He came into the country right after Soapy Smith was killed when he realized it would be safe, and he's been here ever since. And I don't think any further explanation should have to be made to ask you to listen to our good fellow, Tony Sigwall.
Kind of tied down here with all his gadgets. How long do you want me to talk, Bob?
Well, when they start yawning, you're supposed to start closing. So you go right ahead.
What do you want me to do, Roger?
Start right in from the day you left the old firm in Iowa or wherever it was and came up the Pilchuck River and finally got on the boat and came to Alaska.
All right.
Whatever.
Well, I was born in Duluth, Minnesota, and I'll... got of age, why I went to work for the City Water and Light Department there at a civil service job. First World War came along, and I went to work for Uncle Sam. I went down to Kellyfield, Texas, near San Antonio, and there I met a young fellow that he and I just hit it off perfect. And we finally went overseas together on the Hal Roland Mallory. Took us 15 days to go across, and we landed in Bordeaux. So then we were what they call a casual outfit, a replacement squadron. So it was about the time that this big Bertha had dropped her big bomb there in Paris, so they sent a bunch of us up there on what they call the evacuation convoy of Paris. So before the war, when I was working for the City Water and Light Department, I bought a motorcycle. Then they were asking for motorcycle dispatch riders in Paris, and in those days there weren't too many of them, so out of about 500 men, I think there were about 50 of us stood out in front, and they furnished us with leather puttees and leather gauntlets and helmets and all this and that, and we'd go down the street and all these poor rookies, they'd salute us. They thought we were officers. Made us feel pretty good. Anyway, we went through the service there, and I was wounded on this motorcycle and finally caught up with my outfit and met this same fellow again. And the armistice was signed in November, and all during this time, my gosh, this fellow always had money to spend. And with me, I'd wash his socks and his underwear whenever I'd have time, and I'd get a little pay for that. And every once in a while, he'd hand me 20 francs. So, like I say, when the armistice was signed, why, his dad, right away, he got busy and applied for his discharge. And by gosh, he was home for Christmas that year. Well, I didn't get out of there until in July. I finally got back to New York. Came into Hoboken on the 2nd, I think it was, of July, and the Salvation Army came along, and they gave us each two telegrams that we could send to whoever we wanted to. So I sent one to my dad and one to this fellow Deming in Bellingham. He'd been after me all the time. In the meantime, if we get out of this, he said, I want you to be sure to come to Bellingham. Well, in the service, you promise all kinds of things. I had no intentions of going there because I didn't know who he was. Anyway, I had been home about 4 days. By Jiminy, I got a letter from this fellow Deming. And he said, by now, he said, you should have your affairs taken care of and have your dad paid off and for your civilian clothes. Gosh, all we got was $60 bonus, and I spent that in a couple of days, not for clothes. So I showed this telegram to my dad, and he wanted to know, who is this fellow anyway? And I said, I don't know, a buddy of mine that I met in the service. And I went on telling him how he was always giving me money. Well, he said, I don't want you to leave. He said, you go down to the water and light department and see the manager and get back to work so you can pay me for the civilian clothes. So I did. I went down to the office, and my gosh, everybody was glad to see me back and everything. And I went over to my desk, and here was a girl sitting there. I said to the chief clerk, I said, did that girl take my place? And he said, yeah. Well, I said, I don't want the job. Well, he said, you better go and see Manager Reed. So I did. I went in there and talked to him. Well, he said, Sig, when are you coming back to work? And I said, well, I don't know. I said, unless I can get a job working outdoors, I said, I don't want the job. He says, what's wrong? And I said, well, any time a girl can take my job, I don't want it. So he tried to explain to me that this was a case of war, and the men all had to go, and the women had to take over. And still, I'd gotten a little taste of the outside, and I'd gained about 30 or 40 pounds, and had a nice ruddy complexion. Before I left there, I was just a sallow-complected kid, you know. So I said, well, he said, what can you do? He said, you're not an engineer. And well, I said, I'd like to read meters. Well, he said, there's no future in that. Well, anyway, I didn't go back to work. I went to work in a shipyard. So I lasted there about a month, and I got a job as a machinist helper. They were these metal ships, and my job was to get underneath the deck and hang on to those great big nuts that they fasten the winches with. You can imagine in July, and the sun beating down to that thing, and here you are underneath. Well, that didn't last very long. I finally got promoted and got upstairs, and then I had the big wrench up there and tightening the other fellows down below. One day I was standing there pulling on these nuts, tightening them up, and there was a rivet passer facing me, and then behind me was a fellow catching these rivets with a bucket. And we'd talk back and forth, joshing, you know, and just so happened when he was passing this one rivet, it didn't let go in time, and it caught me right under the nose. Split my lip wide open, and so that was the end of my job with the shipyards. And finally then, while I was convalescing, I had got an infection in my tonsil. By Jiminy, I got a night telegram from Bellingham in September, and it said, enclosed fine he wired me $120. We'll meet you at the New Washington Hotel in Seattle on the 21st of September. So I showed this to my dad. Oh, gosh, he felt real bad about it, you know, to think that I've only been home a short time. And he says, who are these people? I said, I don't know who they are. I'm just a fellow I met. And, well, what do they do? I said, I think he's a fisherman. Anyway, I got to Washington, or in Seattle, and he met me at the New Washington Hotel and took me upstairs, and here they had a suite of rooms. He was married when he was in the service and had a little daughter by the name of Catherine. He was 5 years old, and I was this fellow. And with him at the hotel, he also had his mother, his wife, and his daughter. My gosh, when I went up there and they gave me this room, I thought it was the president's room, you know. The next morning, we all went down to breakfast, and after breakfast, they said, well, how'd you like to take a ride, Sig? And fine. So went out there from the hotel, and here's a great big Pierce Arrow limousine pulls up with a chauffeur in it. My God, I sit in this thing, and there we went for a ride. They took me down to Portland. We were gone about 3 days. We came back and stayed another couple of days, and then they took me over to Spokane. Finally, they decided it was time to go home, so we went to Bellingham. Well, then they took me to their home, and I stayed with them. And my gosh, I found out then that his father was the president of the Pacific American Fisheries in Alaska. Well, I stayed with him then, and every once in a while I'd hit him up for a job, and he said, no hurry. He said, my God, here we've been in the Army, he says, for 2 years, we're entitled to a little rest. And don't get worried. And I said, well, I'm getting tired of getting this doling out $20 to me every once in a while. I owe you all this money that you gave me in France, and then you sent me this $120. I want to pay you back. Oh, forget about it. Anyway, I finally got a job, went down and worked the cannery, and then spring came along. That was in the spring of 1920. And they had it all figured out that I was to go to work for his brother-in-law, who was the superintendent of the excursion inlet cannery down out of Juneau. You know where that is? So, by gosh, I went to work there, and the first thing they did, they started me in a filling machine. I'd work on that for about a month, and then they'd put me on the weighing machine, then the vacuum machine, then the retorts where they cooked the fish. Then they'd send me over to the powerhouse and run the boiler for, had worked with the, on the boiler for so long, they had a fertilizing plant there too. So they rotated me that way then for all the months that I was there, so that I could see what they were doing. They were breaking me in as a foreman. The end of the season came, and that was the first time in my life that I'd ever saved any money. So what little I was saving, I'd send it home to my dad. I'd bought 80 acres from him before I went into the service. I still owed him for that, and then I owed him for my clothes. So I paid him off that summer. Fall came, about latter part of August, the cannery shut down. And, I hated to go back. So I went to the superintendent and I told him, I said, isn't there some chance of me staying on a little longer? Well, he said, the only thing that they have now, he said, are these, the pile driver crew is on. He said, look at those fellas out there, a bunch of great big Swedes, 6'6", you know, and I'd look like a peanut alongside of them. So I decided, well, that was it. So 2 days before the boat was ready to come in, it was a Catherine D. We had a telegram from Bering River Cannery. A fellow by the name of Cap Davis was the superintendent. This Bering River Cannery was out of Cordova, across the flats in the Catella area. So he said, here, he says, is your chance if you want to stay in Alaska a little while longer. And he said, you go up there and run the backing machine. Oh my gosh, I said, I haven't had enough experience. He said, never mind. He says, this letter will explain the whole thing. So I went to Juneau on the steamer Estabat. That was a mail steamer. And then I had 4 days to wait for the Northwesterner to come along. So I got mixed up down there a little bit. I'd been in the cannery all summer, and so most of my money I had gone. Anyway, I got on the Northwestern, got into Cordova, and by gosh, I didn't realize I had another wait there because it was so stormy they couldn't come in with a cannery tender. I used to smoke cigars those days, and I'd go down to the Rosswag cigar store, and I was real careful that I didn't spend too much. I was hanging on to what little I had left. A lot of temptations, but I couldn't help that. So I'd go in there and I'd buy about 6 or 8 cigars every morning. So this Genevieve Rosswag, do you know him?
Oh, yeah.
Genevieve said, you know, I'm curious, she said.
She married the banker afterward.
I guess.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So anyway, that's right. So I told her what my purpose of being there, that I was waiting for a cannery tender. And, oh, she said, you're going to Bering River? She said, I have a boyfriend that's over there. And I said, yeah, what's his name? She said, Earl Meehan. Remember him?
Oh, sure.
So she says, will you do me a favor when you go over there, take a box of candy over to him? Well, I was tickled to death because here's a fellow, he'd worked there 3 years, and I knew darn well that if he'd been there 3 years, he knew something about a vacuum machine. So I thought, there's the fellow I'm going to cultivate. Well, I finally got over there and met him. And sure enough, he and I became very good friends. So we finished out the season. I didn't have a bit of trouble. Everything worked out fine. So the deal with the cannery, you get your fare paid both ways, but you have to leave. You can't, after the end of the year, why then that's out. So he said, bye, Jim. He said, why don't you stay? He says, there isn't much doing down in Bellingham this winter anyway. Why don't you stay here this winter? And he said, my girlfriend will find a girl for you. Well, that sounded pretty good to me. And so we went down, and I went out a couple of times, but I don't know, it just didn't click, I guess. So I got followed up there anyway, and finally spent all the money I had looking for a job. And then I was ashamed of myself because I hadn't written to Deming or a darn thing, and here they were expecting me on the last boat. So I went down to the employment office there at the Copper River Northwestern and applied for a job. I wanted to go to work at Latouche, that would be handier for the cannery in the spring. No, they didn't have a thing there, but they said they'd send me up to Kennicott Copper. Well, I didn't know where that was. That was 196 miles inland on the Copper River. So they asked me what my trade was. I told them I was a machinist helper. So I went to work for Kennicott. There was a big line up there. There were two coaches full of fellas going up. So here we were standing in line from early morning until way late in the afternoon. I finally got my turn, and I'll never forget the fellow by the name of Jim Douglas was the superintendent then. So he said, oh, he said, the machinist helper. He said, well, he said, we don't have anything down here. He said, we'll have to send you up to Jumbo Mine. So I said, is that underground? And he said, yes. I says, I've never worked underground. I don't intend to start now. What do you mean? I said, no, sir, I'm not going to work underground. Well, then step out. He said, get the rest of these fellows, get them out. And he says, you go to the end of the line. So I had to way back the end of the line.
Started all over.
And when I came up by then, he told me. He said, well, he says, there probably will be an opening, he said, later on in the machine shop. But he said, in the meantime, the only thing that I can give you in lower camp, they call it, is a laborer's job. So I said, well, that's all right with me. So, by gosh, I went to work in the yard and unloaded the cars and swept the snow and whatnot. And finally, they had a little dam up there that we had to keep the boiler going to keep it from freezing over, you know. So there was an old timer. He sent me out there with an old sourdough. And they had a 6-foot crosscut saw, and I'd never had a crosscut saw in my hand before in my life. So, of course, I'd start in, I'd crap it, you know. And, geez, that fellow, I'll never forget him. Oh, he used to bomb me out something terrible, you know. And I was trying, and then I'd push it, you know, and then we'd bind. And so finally, we got along. After a couple of days, I learned how to handle a saw. So then I was promoted then to what they call a bucket chaser. The mine was 3.5 miles up in the mountains, and that was the only way that they could get their ore down and also their supplies from the main camp. It had to go in these iron buckets, and every one of those buckets hauled 1,000 pounds of ore. And that bucket, there was a bucket come in every minute. The bucket would come in on the tram, and it'd come on a track. It had a clip there to knock the clip off, you know, and then you'd have to push it clear down the end of this warehouse. And we had a rubber mallet there, and we'd hit this clip, the bucket would tip over, and then you'd pound it because the ore was warm when it left the mine, and by the time it got down in the camp, coming down the 3.5 miles, it would freeze. So I had that job done for, about 2 or 3 months. And finally, my job opened up at the machine shop. But instead of being a machinist helper, I was a plumber's helper. So I'll never forget the fellow by the name of Gus Carlson, great big Swede, about 6'4", you know, and I'd go around helping him, and they had the leaching plant there, and we had one of the pipes had broken. It was a 6-inch pipe, and we had to replace. Well, gosh, we had to get this pipe out of the rack up by the machine shop, and the leaching plant was down about 4 blocks down the railroad track. And of course, this fella, he grabs a hold of one end and puts it on his shoulder and expected me to do the same thing, you know. So we started down the track, and by Jimmy, that thing getting heavy, cutting in my shoulder blades, you know, and I'd hold my hands there and I'd holler, Gus, I said, I can't go any farther. He'd say, turn on, used a little farther, he'd say, used a little farther. Jeez, I kept on, and I'd hold this thing up there, and I said, Gus, I've got to drop this. I said, I can't go any farther. Just a little farther. My God, I couldn't go any farther, so I just let her go. You know, he had that thing on his shoulder, and you can imagine what it did to him when that thing hit the ground. The minute I dropped it, I knew I was in for trouble. I turned right around and started for the machine shop, and he after me. Anyway, I got there ahead of him, and I told the foreman what had happened, and I stood back there by the office, and oh, that fellow was mad. Anyway, that was the last of me. I got all of that. That was the last time I went to work for the plumber's helper. I finally got transferred into the warehouse there. So during the time I worked in the warehouse, I was rooming with the fellow there, that fellow named Con Miller, and he was an old timer. And the fellows around the bunkhouse saw that we were being real friendly, and they fellows kind of took a liking to me. They said, you want to watch out for that Con Miller. Every time there's a young fella comes here to work and he saves his money, Con Miller is watching him, and in the spring of the year he'll tell you that he's got a good gold mine, and that he'll clue you in on this, and if you just put up some more money, so you got a prospect. Sure enough, by Jimmy, about December, first of January, Con says, oh, he said, my gosh, he said, I'm just short about $500. He said, I know darn well I'm going to hit pay dirt next spring. I was all set for him, and I didn't say a word. So it went on for another couple of days, and he said, how about it? He said, you and I'll go out. And he said, You put in $500, I'll put up $500. By Jimmy Conn, I said, I'm sorry, I can't do it. I said, I just sent the last bit of money I had back to my father. And he didn't speak to me for about 2 months. He was 11 years old. So finally he went down to McCarthy, which is about 5 miles from Kennicott, and that was a sort of a playground for the miners. There were about 1,500 men that they employed up there between Kennicott and a place called Green Butte. So he came home about 5 o'clock in the morning and was feeling pretty good and woke me up and he says, boy, he said, I've got a proposition. He said, Joe Burns and his wife split up and his wife left for the outside. Joe wants to sell this restaurant and rooming house. And they had 21 rooms upstairs and a restaurant downstairs. Why? He said, I don't know anything about a restaurant. I never cooked in my life. You don't have to. He says, I'm a good cook. He said, and I know that you've been a bookkeeper. And he says, you keep the books. And he says, you can wash the dishes and haul the water and empty the slop buckets and make the beds. So, I didn't know. By gosh, that didn't sound too bad, you know. So, of course, I talked it up around the gang up around camp. And anyway, I went downtown with him this one night. And we made a deal, by gosh, with this Mr. Burns. So we bought the restaurant and the rooming house. We started in the business. Like I say, I couldn't even cook coffee, you know. But I had plenty of other work to do. In the morning, my first job would be to haul the water. There's no water or anything. And I got a hold of two dogs and one of those 55-gallon barrels. I've got a picture of it. I was going to bring it down here, a two-wheel cart. And then these two dogs, and I'd go down to the city well. That was at the jail. And had one of those long handle pumps, you know, and I'd pump that thing full of water, and then the dogs would pull it up the hill and back of the restaurant, and I'd take a water hose and siphon down into the kitchen. In the kitchen, we had two 110-gallon barrels, metal. One was for hot water, and the other was for cold. Upstairs, we had the same thing for a bath, so I had quite a job filling these tanks every day. Then my next job would get the wood in, and by that time the dishes would be all piled up in the sink in the kitchen, and I'd get busy washing the dishes. So anyway, this went on. By gosh, pretty soon I learned to fry eggs and bacon, and how to make coffee, and of course hot cider, hot cakes. And I had to go to Cordova for a trip, and when I came back, we were paying this landlady $100 a month rent for this building. On one side was a little drugstore, and then we had the lobby downstairs and the 21 rooms upstairs. So when I came back from Cordova, my partner had rented the upstairs out to one of the girls in town. And he was getting, $75 a month for the upstairs, and then all it was costing was $25 downstairs. Well, all of my work was through then. I didn't have to make beds with the slop buckets. But it wasn't a very good situation because she was the wrong type, and so the marshal came to me and told me something had to be done, and I told him I know it, but what am I going to do? Well, he said, you work with me, he says, and I'll work with you. So, and of course, I didn't even speak to my partner. So we arranged it, by gosh, that we finally got the goods on this person, and they railroaded her, and so I got the upstairs back, and my partner and I split up. So I got a hold of three women then to help me. One would get up in the morning and make the breakfast and the lunches, and another one come on at 11 o'clock and take care of the tables, and then I did all the heavy work, like the hauling of the water and emptying the slop buckets and taking care of the chemical toilets and so forth. And that was quite a problem there, the chemical toilet business. There were pool halls there and other hotels, and by Jimmy, you'd go in the pool hall there and ask some of these fellows to take two of these buckets, one in each hand. All they had to do was walk about four blocks down the river and throw a can and all in there and give them a dollar piece. You couldn't get them, you know. Then you'd have to do that yourself after dark.
Dr. Lester there
in those days. Yeah, I'll get up to that. So anyway, my gosh, I run the restaurant then for, another year or so, and then went back to work at Kennicott. And I hadn't been there too long. There was a young fellow down there that had a taxi cab, so he wanted me to go in with him. And that's a long story. I finally went in with him against my boss's wishes, of course, up there. And we only lasted a year. So then after I bought him out, there's a fellow named O'Neill had a mercantile store. Then he had a Model T Ford with a chain drive, solid rubber tires, and he said, now, Siggy, he said, I'll tell you what, I'll sell you this truck. And he said, it won't cost you a dime. He said, all you have to do is haul the freight, and then you'll apply the money on this purchase of the truck. Well, that was a pretty good deal. And after having this experience in the hotel with garbage and toilet cans and whatnot, why, I thought that would be a darn good business. So I went around to these different business houses like the pool hall and the rooming house and all the way down the line that way. So I made him a proposition. I said, I'll build a platform in back of your place, truck height, and I'll furnish you with all the cans you want, and I'll put a wire bale in it. I'll charge you a dollar a piece, but you have to have them on the platform. In the meantime, then, I'd also gotten into the wood business, because those girls, they'd come in and they'd stay there in the summertime and leave in the winter, and they couldn't buy any wood in the summertime because the only time you get your wood was in the winter when they, with horses, see, in the snow. So I started a wood yard and had plenty of sawdust, so I was running this taxi cab, take some of these fellows up the mine, come back about 3 or 4 in the morning, and jump out of a taxi and grab my Model T Ford and run up and spread about 4 inches of sawdust in the bed of the truck and start on down through the alley and take these 5-gallon cans and set them in there. And there was nothing to do with it, to pick up 40 and, oh, well, that's 40 or 50. I'd get that twice a week. And it would only take me about an hour and a half, you know. And then when I get down there, I'd take bale, can and all, throw her overboard into the river. And then I had my broom there, and I'd sweep the sawdust off into the deck of the bridge and sweep all of it into the river. Then I had another can there with a rope on it, and I'd dip that down in there and swish this truck all out and clean it out real good. So one day, about 5 o'clock in the morning, my gosh, here was a poor old soul sitting on the edge of the bank, and he was watching me do this. So he came over and he said, geez, Siggy, he said, I feel tough this morning. He said, you don't happen to have a drink, do you? No, I said, not with me, but I said, if you want to wait a while, I said, get up the garage. I said, I've got a bottle up there in the garage. So he stuck around and watched me. So he went up the garage and gave him a good couple of good slugs, and boy, he felt fine then, you know, and walked away, and I went upstairs and went to bed. So I haven't told you, but then I got into the ice business, too, because they had all this homebrew, you know, and no ice. So the girls down there, they always had a hole in their kitchen floor, and then they had, that's where they put their homebrew and their moonshine, you know. So then I got the idea I'd sell them ice, which I did. I'd put up 20 tons of ice. So this happened to be the day that my ice delivery. So I went and started around making my rounds, and about the third house I came to, by gosh, here's my old friend that I'd given a drink to that morning. And oh, he said, Daisy, he said, give us a drink. Boy, he saved my life this morning. And I said, well, wait, where till I get this ice in here? So I had to take all that beer out of the hole, set it on the floor, and then go out, and I had a 5-foot crosscut saw, and I'd cut it the size to fit the hole, you know, put it down in there and put all the stuff back again, and then I'm all ready for my drink. So while I'm doing that, this fellow's standing looking out the window, and had the drink in his hand. Daisy handed me my drink, and I said, well, here's a go, Joe. He said, wait a minute, he said, isn't that the truck I saw you hauling? mind you, I've been doing it then for a couple of years. And I said, yeah, by God, it is, yeah. Well, he said, son of a gun. He says, here, Daisy, no more ice for me. So, you know, that bothered me to no end. And old Doc Lesby, he was the health inspector, see? And a very good friend of mine. So, by gosh, one day I went up and I said, by Jimmy, I said, I'm afraid I'm going to be in trouble. I says, we said, what's wrong now? So I told him about this fellow. Oh, he says, pay no attention to it. He says, that moonshine will kill any germ. let's see, I don't know what else I could tell you. From there, well, there's a lot of things that happened while I was there. I'll have to tell you one interesting thing. The mine shut down in 1930, and it was down for about 2 years. And during that time, then, of course, there was no taxi business. But there was a bridge across the Mazena River that used to go out every year in the month of July. So there was a fellow there by the name of Pete Brenwick. He had 15 head of horses, and I had the trucks. So we'd take the... on the other side of the river was Dan Creek. That was a big placer mine, and also Chittatoo. Have you been up there, Ed? Up there to McCarthy? Oh, anyway, and then there was a road commission had a big camp over there, and an outfit by the name of Hammond that came down from Nome. They were going to prospect and see if it was feasible to put a dredge in there. So we had all kinds of freight on the other side of the river, and the only way you could get it across was by horses. So I had the trucks and he had the horses, and before the lake breaks there and takes the river, the bridge out. So I parked one truck on one side of the river and one on the other. So we'd start out from town at 3 o'clock in the morning and get out the river about 5, and then we'd have to go and wrangle our horses. Sometimes we'd find them in an hour, and sometimes take you 3 or 4 if you wouldn't hear the bell. And of course, you know how the willows are early in the morning. You'd be soaking wet before you ever get started. So then we'd finally get all of our horses packed by 11 or 12 o'clock, just before the river starts raising again, and that's the way we spent the summer. So during that time, then, they didn't have a doctor up at Kennicott, and...
Can you hold it?
Yeah.
We'll turn this tape over and start on the other side.
I'll have to tell you this story. During the 2 years that the mine was shut down, like I say, they didn't have a doctor up there, and then there were several old-timers that were found in their cabins dead, and the commissioner appointed me as the undertaker. So I'd go out and get them, and of course, we always had a coroner's jury along. This one time, I'll never forget it, a fella came in from the creeks and reported to the commissioner that he found Lee Yancey dead in his cabin, at Dancrick cabin. And of course, the commissioner immediately had to wire Juno and give all the information that Lee Yancey was found dead in his cabin. And so he appointed six of us as juries, and I took my pickup out I had a 1922 and a 1918 Dodge touring car. Went over there, and sure enough, here's old Lee over in his bunk there. It was double bunk. And come in the door here, and right here was a small window, like all these cabins, you know. And his bunk was over there. So Rao walked in, and on the table was a little revolver, .32, I'll never forget it. So everybody grabbed this looking. One shell was gone, one shot. Went over there, and here's this fellow laying in the bunk with his hand up over his head. Gee, that's too bad, old Lee. So we wrapped him up and made a stretcher, and we had to carry it about a mile out to the road. Brought him in, brought him up to the A.B. Hall. That was the only place we could take him. So there was a young fellow just moved up to Kennicott, a new doctor. This was after Dr. Gillespie left. So the commissioner told me, well, you go up and get Dr. Wilson and come on down and you help him with the autopsy. So I did, come down there, and he started in at the head, starting taking his shirt off, and I was supposed to take his socks off. He didn't have any shoes on. First thing I thought, my gosh, he had nice clean socks, and I knew Lee Yancey hadn't had a bath for 5 years. And I thought, gee, that's funny, that can't be Lee. So I pulled this one sock off, and underneath was a silk sock. And then I knew it wasn't Lee, so I said, wait a minute, Doc. Here he had his rubber gloves, and he was all ready to work on him. I said, what's the matter? I said, this isn't Lee Yancey. He says, what? I said, this isn't Lee Yancey. Well, what do you mean you've got the wrong corpse? I said, you're darn right. I said, this is Howard Foster. He just took his rubber gloves off and threw them down in this fool's chest and walked out the door. I thought he was going out to have a cigarette. So I waited and didn't come back. And went out there and I said, what's the matter? What are you going to do? Why, he said, I'm not going to touch that fellow. He said, that isn't Lee Yancey. He says, if you tell me it's Howard Foster, and I'm supposed to come down here and form an autopsy on Lee Yancey. So I said, well, I'll go down and tell the commissioner. So I ran down the street, stopped the first pool hall, and they're all pin pan, you know. So here was old Howard Foster's partner, fellow named Al Duback, and I said, Al, my gosh, I said, come here, I want to talk to you. Well, they don't want to be bothered when they're playing pan. So I said, come on. So he said, what do you want? So I said, tell him. I said, that's Howard Foster. Gee, the minute I told him that, the game was over. Everybody left, and out the door they went. On the way down to the commissioner's office, there was another pool hall, and I did the same thing, and of course they all left their cards. And then I went to the commissioner, and boy, if I didn't hit the fan there. Oh, he was an old-timer, you know, and oh, he was mad. He bawled the dickens on me. I was only one of the jurors. All the rest of the brothers all made the same mistake. But it was dark in there, and we just took it for granted it was Lee until we found out got him in the daylight where you could see him. Oh, man, what a mess.
He was still dead, though.
Oh, sure, he was dead. Well, anyway, we finally got that straightened out. I'd had to take the doctor back, though, until we got permission from Juno to go ahead and form the autopsy on Howard Foster. You know, that thing, this doctor then moved down to Ketchikan, and I hadn't seen him since. And he was just a young intern, just came up from training. So when I was down to the Pioneers Convention in Ketchikan last fall, I made up my mind, boy, I'm sure going to go and see this Dr. Wilson. So I did. And my gosh, we didn't have a party, you know, just reminiscing. And he said, you know, I've thought of that story. And he said, I've been trying to, and they had, in the meantime, then he has raised a family. He has two of his boys, and one of them's a doctor with him, partner. And he said, oh, I wish you could wait. He said, not maybe about a half hour. He said, he's busy with a patient in there. I want you to meet him, and I want you to tell him this story. So, of course, I waited and told the kid, you know. He wouldn't even believe it. Oh, Lordy. Then, in 1937, I got wind that Kennicott was shutting down for good. He was shut down 2 years, from 1930 to 32. So I got busy, and by gosh, I got a fellow to buy me out, two of them. And I told him, I said, well, you know, the mine is shutting down in 1938. And, oh, well, we know it shut down in 32, but they will never quit up there. Well, a great big camp like they had, and you really wouldn't think they would shut down, you know. Anyway, I sold out in 37, and then I came to Fairbanks. And you remember Chet Spencer? He was putting a sawmill up at over on Garden Island, back of the old Standard Oil station there, that spur that runs in the FE company. So I'd go over there every morning, and I didn't know what I wanted. I went over to Sourdough Express, and I was going to get a job, but I thought, oh boy, this is too big an outfit for me. All I had was a haywire outfit up there in McCarthy, you know. So finally, this fellow said, gee, you got a little money. Why don't you go in and buy in on this thing? So I went and finally asked Chet for a job. I could see they were hard up for money. So I worked there for a week, and Saturday to come, and no money. So I said, how much do you need, Chet? Gee, he looked at me, he said, have you got some money? And I said, oh, a little bit. Well, he said, come on up to Bill McCarty. Remember Bill McCarty worked for the FE company? He was an engineer. Mm-hmm. Well, he was one of the stockholders. He and a boy by the name of Christensen.
Harold Christensen?
No, I think his name was George.
George,
yeah. So they, we had the meeting, and of course I loaned them $2,500. Boy, that was just like grabbing a straw, you know. Start all over. And we had our logging camp down at Standard then. We used to ship our logs up on the flat cars. So, then Doc Lespie had a chance to buy that apartment house on 3rd and Cushman from Mrs. McIntosh. But he wouldn't buy it unless I'd go in with him. He said, I don't know the first thing about an apartment house. And he said, I can't be bothered running an apartment house anyway. But he said, it's a good deal. And if you want to go in with me, why, I'd be glad to have you. So I still had a little left. And so he and I bought that apartment house at the time. And then I ran that sawmill until 1942. And 1941, Romy Hoyt dropped dead in his house down there on Cowles. And I always had my eye on that fellow. That was just about my speed. He had that old Graham Brothers Dodge truck, remember? And he always had a little black bow tie, and he was neat, and the old truck was always shiny, you know, and he had all the gadgets on it. Now, that boy, that's just about my speed. My gosh, this poor fellow died, and I didn't want to go down and bother his widow for a couple of days. In the meantime, this fellow that worked for Ernie Shermer, his name was Reed Martin?
Larry Reed.
He beat me to it. He'd been down there and already talked to her. But I happened to have a couple of friends that knew Sadie Hoyt real well, and they put in a plug for me, and I bought the thing. And the day that I bought it was on a Friday, and we couldn't get the papers drawn up, so we had to wait until Monday. And Sunday was December the 7th when they bombed Pearl Harbor. Well, gee whiz, I thought I'd made a bum deal, you know, and she thought that I was going to back out. So she called me and asked me to come down to see her, and she says, oh, sake, she said, if you don't back out, she says, I'll knock off another $500. I said, oh, no. I said, that was the deal. So that's how I happened to buy the story to transfer out. And I've been here ever since. You know, I was going to start making notes this afternoon. I thought, any time that I want to get followed up, that's all I have to do, is make notes to myself, and I really will get fooled up.
Go ahead,
Sig. So, What was it going to... Oh, yeah.
About this. Oh, well, Yancey
era. Yeah. Well, anyway, we finally... We buried Howard Foster. And it wasn't too long after that this fellow that came in and reported this man dead, he committed suicide, so... They figured that... They call it suicide. Everything was
well,
suicide.
I was going to say, you found a revolver on
yeah.
the table and the man had his hands over his
mm-hmm.
eyes there. Did he kill himself?
They call it suicide, but we found out later that it couldn't have been suicide because you know how the this Nazina River would overflow every
yeah.
spring and the floor was just full of silt. He had a pair of white socks on, woolen socks. His shoes were by the door. There wasn't a bit of sand on the bottom of his stockings. And then the bullet had gone down straight. We took a one of those American flags sticks and shot it down through that way. And that's the way that, in order to shoot himself, he'd had to take his thumb and pull the trigger, see? Anyway, we couldn't find any bullet holes in the bunk. So, anyway, they finally called it suicide.
I was wondering how a guy could shoot himself and not kill himself and then lay the pistol over on the table. That's what was interesting me.
Well, do you know, Bob, that you can do that?
Well, maybe.
I'll tell you why. I happen to have... There's another one I had up there. But you can, if you shoot yourself, even though it goes through your heart, you can run, 25 feet before you fall. There was a young kid up there I was delivering, and then I had the laundry agency. I forgot to tell you about that.
Brother, that was a one-man town up there.
About 6 months later, by Jiminy, we did finally Yancey. He was dead in his cabin. And he'd been there for about a month before anybody discovered it. So they call that suicide. He had a bunk over here, and right alongside of his bunk was a trap door. And when we found him, he was laying flat on the floor with his head underneath this trap door, and the trap door was over his face. So they claimed that he tripped and grabbed a hold of this door and fell and knocked himself out with the door, and that's how he died. So that was suicide. That was suicide.
Did they call that suicide, too?
Yeah. And then I should tell you about this.
The owner of the clean socks.
Huh?
They ever locate the owner of the clean socks?
The clean socks that this fella had on.
Oh, well, they belong to the Howard Foster. Oh. Yeah, he was a clean fella, a real nice fella.
What became of your original truck?
By Jiminy, I sold that with the business, and that the fellas had it there for years after that. And then I finally put a Ruxell axle in it instead of the chain drive.
What came of the young fellow that you
want
to tell about?
The
ran.
The what?
That ran 25 feet after he shot himself.
Oh, yeah. There was a young fellow that worked up at Kennicott, and he got married, and he lived downtown, and then he had to drive up to Kennicott every day in a car. He rented this from a fellow named Henry Olson, with an old beat-up Chevrolet, and he was having nothing but trouble. And his folks wouldn't have anything to do with him, and they didn't like the girl he married. So, one night I was delivering laundry and went to his house, and his wife was home sitting in the front room in the Davenport. So I collected for the laundry, talked to her for a while, and as I walked out the door, I noticed that there was a couple of flat tires on his car. And I turned around, and here was Buster sitting in the garage there, and he had an old satchel, one of those suitcases, you know, satchel, digging in there. And I walked in, and the minute I walked in, well, he closed it up real fast, and I said, "Hey, Buster," I said, "did you know that you had a couple of flat tires?" He said, "Yeah, I know all about it." He said, "I'm going to fix them." And he didn't want to talk to me. So I left, and I went down and started delivering the rest of my laundry. I'd been gone, maybe 15 minutes, and just making the round by the grocery store, and my wife came running out of the house, and she said, "Sig," she said, "Buster shot himself." Well, I said, "No, he didn't." I said, "It just came from there. Just got through delivering the laundry." Well, he did. So I ran on over there and went upstairs to the marshal's office, which was next door. And I told him, I said, "My wife tells me that Buster shot himself." He said, "I heard the noise, but," he said, "I was waiting for somebody to come." And I said, "Well, that's it." So we went on down. What he'd done, he'd gone in, that's what he was after when he was in the garage. He was getting this revolver out of his satchel. And he went in there, and there was a bedroom over here, and it was one of those partway partitions, you know, bookshelf underneath, and then a shelf here. She was sitting over on the Davenport, and he took two shots at her, and she screamed. And what we figure is that he probably thought that he killed her. Then, after he shot the two shots at her, he turned the gun on himself, and he ran from the bedroom through the living room and through the kitchen, and he dropped dead out on the porch.
It didn't hit her at all.
How's it done? You didn't get to be the marshal up there, too.
Well, that was a political job, though. You had to buy the jail.
The postmaster. Those are the only three things you missed.
That well, was quite a town.
The story of what happened to Rummy Hoyt, whom he bought out, whose estate he bought out, is an interesting story that this historical society should have a tape on, too. And the trial he had when he was accused of robbing the post office here. And the sentiment was so strong around here locally that his attorney, Mr. Markham, asked for a change of venue, and the trial was held in Juneau, where he was acquitted of robbing the post office. That story is worth recording for posterity, too, because a lot of people don't know anything about it. And I know all about it because I was in it, and I was subpoenaed as a witness by Mr. Markham in the year when I was a member of the legislature down there when the trial was being held. And Brother Young was also a witness at that time down there. Frank can either tell about that, or I will sometime when we get time and got nothing else to do. I mean, something not knowing for it. But all those things are incidents. Like the Black Bear case is a historical thing that I think we're going to have a record of some of these days, too.
Yeah.
I think we've got it on its way where we've got Bill Burke over here, the former early day mail carrier, knows all about it, and he has made a tape for Harry Hughes, which will be available for him. And we may care to write the story up. It's one of the most interesting mail robberies that we ever had up here. And incidentally, one of the most interesting cases in court.
That was in 23, wasn't it?
Well, I forget 22. The year right now.
I was in the inaugural.
It's a matter of record, but the exact year I just don't recall. How did you get from shipping out of Fairbanks, Nick?
I saved out one of my Dodges and shipped it down my railroad and then drove it from Chittenden over here.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. Well, in those days, I was in the transportation business, too. I'm sorry you and I didn't get hooked up like you did with that guy from Bellingham, and I might have been a wealthy man today, too. But the interesting thing to me is it shows you that these men in Alaska who finally become wealthy, they start in from a pretty low level in a stinking business of hauling garbage, and Captain Lathrop was carrying coal on his back when he got his start. I've seen Cap Lathrop carrying sacks of coal on his back in Cordova up the stairway to the people who lived up on the hill, and that's where Cap got his start. And it was just interesting that very similar to Sig's life's history in Alaska, Cap Lathrop's history was very, very similar. They started right in from the grassroots, and maybe even a little below the grassroots. I don't know.
May I ask you about that?
For sure, pardon me.
Sig, will you give your full name and spell it, and where you was born, and your father and mother's name when you come to it, if you remember them? And if you have any brothers and sisters, let's get as much details on you for later years when they write it up.
Good.
Start with your own name in full.
My name is Sigurd, S-I-G-U-R-D, W-O-L-D. My father's name was Peter Wold. I don't remember my mother's name. And then I have a sister I did have, my sister by the name of Austrey, a brother by the name of Martin. They were both older than I. I was a third one. Then came Agnes, Ruth, Margaret, and Arnold. There were seven of us in the family.
Seven. And do you know if any of your relations are still alive?
Well, yes, there are three of us left. My brother that's older than myself, and of course myself, and a sister by the name of Margaret. Then I have a half-sister and a half-brother that are still living back in Duluth.
Now, what is your birthday, where you were born, the town you were born in, and your birthday?
I was born in Duluth, Minnesota on April the 24th. I'm not going to tell you what year. 1896.
1936. He's got me beat for 4 years.
I mentioned 39 years old.
I beat myself.
That helps to make.
Dave's
that. You told the story. You can top that up.
I don't even, what
this
is it?
The date is January 24th, 1963, at the Tanaw Yukon Historical Society at Fairbanks, Alaska. And Sigwald has given a story of some of his experiences in his life here in the Alaska area. Okay?